Hello, everyone out there. This is Mike Lindell of MyPillow, and I would love for you all getting involved to support Brandon Stations and his network. If you use the promo code WVW, you can save up to 66% off all my products at MyPillow.com, and half the proceeds are going to go to support his great network. Thank you.
WVW Broadcast Network is pleased to present the Pry Report with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. Dr. Pry was an intelligence officer with the Central Intelligence Agency and was responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy, operational plans, military doctrine, threat perceptions, and developing U.S. paradigms for strategic warning. Dr. Pry is executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, a congressional advisory board dedicated to achieving protection of the United States from electromagnetic pulse, cyber warfare, mass destruction terrorism, and other threats to civilian critical infrastructures. Dr. Pry has also served on the staffs of several congressional commissions. Due to his expertise, he's been a guest on numerous national and international radio and television programs, such as Life, Liberty, and Levin, with host Mark Levin on the Fox News Channel, Lou Dobbs Tonight on Fox Business, and the BBC made his book War Scare into a two-hour TV documentary, and his book Electric Armageddon was the basis for a TV documentary by National Geographic. Dr. Pry has written numerous books on national security that include Blackout Wars, Apocalypse Unknown, Electric Armageddon, and War Scare, Russia and America on the Nuclear Brink. And now, here is your host, Dr. Peter Pry.
Welcome to another edition of the Pry Report, speaking to you on September 13th, 2021. On a Monday after the 9/11 weekend, the weekend marking Patriot Day on September 11th, 2021, the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. 20 years ago, the terrorist attacks of 9/11 killed some 3,000 Americans. It was a psychological shock comparable to Imperial Japan's surprise attack on the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, that bludgeoned the United States into World War II. Both 9/11 and Pearl Harbor resulted, to put it kindly, from profound failures in military intelligence and failures of strategic imagination. To put it less kindly, 9/11 and Pearl Harbor happened because of arrogance, complacency, and willful blindness in Washington. Pearl Harbor surprised Washington elites and experts. Imperial Japan was supposed to be deterred by a U.S. oil embargo, by the U.S. forward deploying its Pacific Fleet from San Diego to Hawaii, and Washington experts assumed that Japanese aircraft carriers were not supposed to be able to sink U.S. battleships. You know, it had never been done before. And Captain Billy Mitchell, in fact, had been court-martialed for proving that an aircraft carrier could sink a battleship. And he was court-martialed for that. The U.S. Navy didn't want to believe it. They thought battleships were going to be the weapon of the future. And they didn't even want to build aircraft carriers. The reason we ended up with aircraft carriers at the beginning of World War II was because a visionary chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, a civilian, Carl Vinson, the Congressman Carl Vinson, forced the Navy to build aircraft carriers. Similarly, 9/11 surprised Washington elites and experts. Terrorists were supposed to be deterred from attacking the U.S. homeland. And airliners were not supposed to be hijacked and flown into buildings. This had never been done before. After Pearl Harbor and 9/11, Washington elites and experts were shocked into what's called out-of-the-box thinking about unprecedented threats. Pearl Harbor and World War II spurred the United States to think of new weapon systems and resulted and most dramatically in terms of thinking out of the box, resulted in the invention of the A-bomb. The 9/11 terrorist attacks raised legitimate fears about weapons of mass destruction terrorism, otherwise known as WMD terrorism, the use of chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons of mass destruction in the U.S. homeland. You know, for a decade or more after the 9/11 attacks, there was a lot of literature, whole books written about WMD terrorism. But as time passed, 20 years after 9/11, arrogance, complacency, and willful blindness have returned to Washington, setting up the U.S. and its allies for a wide range of possible unprecedented surprises, including WMD terrorism. You don't see much written about WMD terrorism anymore. Certainly not a lot of books about it. We have dropped our guard again, and our psychological attitude in Washington, especially with the new leadership brought in by the Biden administration, you know, is very similar to the attitudes of the Clinton administration and the Obama administration when it comes to weapons of mass destruction terrorism. Arrogance, complacency, and willful blindness can't happen here. 20 years after 9/11, arrogance, complacency, and willful blindness have returned to Washington. 20 years after 9/11, the Afghanistan debacle displays a scale of incompetence in the White House and Pentagon that, in the context of similarly bungled U.S. superpower responsibilities in Europe, in Asia, or the Middle East, could kill millions. I can give you an example of something that's happening right now, today. You know, Russia has launched a huge military exercise, a major military exercise, mobilizing 200,000 troops opposite NATO, surrounding Ukraine, in Belarus and in eastern Russia, surrounding Ukraine, and going all the way up into the Arctic Circle against NATO's northern flank. They are basically, it's a dress rehearsal for an invasion of NATO and starting World War III and winning World War III. You're not hearing much about it. Zapad 21, it's called. That's what the Russians call it, West 21. You know, because we're so fixated on our problems. We are so complacent that people aren't worried that Russia might actually invade. But why not? Why shouldn't they be worried about that? I will give the Biden administration credit that earlier in the year when they first took office, they were terrified, and NATO was terrified by a big Russian exercise like this, like Zapad 21. You know, because they thought that Russia might actually be getting ready to invade Ukraine and the frontline NATO states. And our own war games by the Pentagon and by independently done by the RAND Corporation have proven that Russia could roll over Ukraine and the frontline NATO states in Eastern Europe in just 72 hours, 3 days. You know, worse than that, since Russia has a 10-to-1 advantage in tactical nuclear weapons, they could probably blast their way across the relatively weak NATO forces that are there, blast their way across NATO Europe in a week and reach the English Channel and conquer NATO Europe. And who knows? This exercise might turn into that exactly. You know, we don't know. You know, the Russian and their military doctrine, it calls for starting World War III by mobilizing their troops and pretending that they're engaged in an exercise. You know, so they basically would start a war because it gives them a head start on mobilizing both nuclear and conventional forces. And people, you know, they do so many of these exercises, will say, oh, it's just another military exercise. But someday, who knows, maybe now, you know, they'll basically launch the war to conquer the world. That's their plan. That's their thinking. But the people in Washington that we rely upon for our security, the president, the White House, the intelligence agencies, the Pentagon, look how they screwed up in Afghanistan. You know, they got that so wrong. They got that so wrong. So how can we trust them on the even bigger issues like the security of NATO Europe or the security of our Pacific allies against aggression from China? You know, one of the things that they're arguing is that, for example, is that, oh, China isn't ready to invade Taiwan yet. They don't have the sea lift capability to invade Taiwan. Did the United States have to invade Japan during World War II in order to get Japan to surrender? No, we didn't. You know, not a single American soldier had to put boots on the ground in Japan. You know, we've got Japan to surrender by aerial bombing and including the use of the atomic bombs. How come China can't do that today? They could do it today. You know, they've got massed missile and air power. They've actually done a number of exercises practicing that, and they've got nuclear weapons. You know, they recently threatened to do a nuclear first strike on Japan and conquer Japan and then occupy Japan afterwards if even a single Japanese soldier came to the defense of Taiwan. So I imagine that they would do the same against the United States. My point being that the elites got it so wrong, our Washington experts, quote unquote, got it so wrong in Afghanistan. How can we trust that they're right, that we still have time when it comes to Chinese aggression and aggression by China against our Pacific allies? You know, we're really set up for a 9/11 or Pearl Harbor type surprise attack by Russia or China or by North Korea or Iran, because we have incompetent people in charge in Washington. And that's what I mean by 20 years after 9/11, the Afghanistan debacle displays a scale of incompetence at the White House and Pentagon that, in the context of similarly bungled U.S. superpower responsibilities in Europe, Asia, or the Middle East, could kill millions. 20 years after 9/11, the Taliban control of Afghanistan, where they, Al-Qaeda, ISIS-K, and other terrorists will again have a national base for worldwide operations, as they did 20 years ago. Except now the Taliban are armed with two more decades of resentment against the U.S. They've been fighting a war against the U.S. for two more decades and have all kinds of desires for revenge built up against us. And now they have stockpiles of sophisticated U.S. arms 20 years after 9/11. 20 years after 9/11, U.S. Department of Homeland Security was established after 9/11 to prevent weapons of mass destruction terrorism. But what is the DHS doing now? Now the Department of Homeland Security, instead of focusing on protecting us from WMD terrorism, it now oversees an unprotected U.S. border and actually transports thousands of unvetted illegal aliens to resettle in the U.S. homeland. And that policy hasn't changed despite what happened in Afghanistan, despite a Taliban that would love to take revenge against the United States, despite a Taliban that has a religious theological commitment to attacking infidels wherever they are, wherever they live. 20 years after 9/11, the possibility of nuclear terrorism is greater now than it was 20 years ago. Now, North Korea has nuclear weapons, including the hydrogen bomb, and it will sell virtually anything to anybody. Now that the Taliban are triumphant, radical Islamists will be inspired everywhere, including in a nuclear-armed Pakistan. There are, we know, radical Islamists already in the Pakistani government, especially in the military and security services. Pakistan, our so-called ally, was helping the Taliban for those 20 years because they sympathized with them. And despite what they say publicly, pretending to be our ally, they didn't want the United States in their backyard in Afghanistan, and they're glad we're gone. Nuclear-armed Pakistan, you know, could become a terror state overnight by a coup. But the biggest worry is Iran, the world's leading sponsor of international terrorism. That's Iran. And Iran is now a threshold for actual nuclear power. 20 years after 9/11, the Biden administration's unrequited love affair with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that's the Obama-Iran nuclear deal, is actually helping Iran nuclearize. you know, which is the same thing as advancing nuclear terrorism. So the Biden administration's continued pursuit of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, is actually helping Iran become a nuclear weapon state, if they are not one already, which I think they are. A title of a recent article is Iran's Nuclear Weapons, Weeks Away. That's the title of a recent article by scholar Majin Rafizadeh, who is president of the International American Council on the Middle East, and he's a Harvard-trained scholar. I'm quoting from his article. Once again, it seems that the mullahs of Iran are masterfully playing the Biden administration and the European Union by stalling nuclear talks, buying time to get more concessions, and accelerating their enrichment of uranium and their nuclear program to reach a weapons-grade nuclear breakout. His article is well worth reading. It's in the Gatestone Institute, published on 9 September 2021. And Israel agrees. Israel agrees with his analysis. According to Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz, he briefed at Israel's foreign ministry on August 4th. And here's a quote from Israel's defense minister. Iran has violated all of the guidelines set in the JCPOA and is only around 10 weeks away from acquiring weapons-grade materials necessary for a nuclear weapon. I'm going to repeat that. It's only 10 weeks away. Iran is only 10 weeks away from acquiring weapons-grade materials necessary for a nuclear weapon. Now is the time for deeds. Words are not enough. It is time for diplomatic, economic, and even military deeds, so says Israel's defense minister, Benny Gantz. However, the situation is probably even worse than Benny Gantz thinks. Several senior U.S. national security officials have been warning for years that, as our most recent article is entitled, Iran probably already has the bomb. I co-authored this with this article, which is also well worth reading. We published it on the 19th of March, 2021 in National Review. National Review, 19 March, 2021. And this article is co-authored by former CIA Director Jim Woolsey, the former White House Science Advisor and NASA Director Dr. William Graham, who was also my boss, on the chairman of the Congressional EMP Commission, former Director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Henry Cooper, and former Chairman of the National Intelligence Council Fritz Ehrmacht. All of us agree that Iran has probably had the bomb for years. We assessed that prior to 2003, Iran was enriching uranium, did implosion testing, was manufacturing neutron initiators and bridge wire detonators, and designing a nuclear warhead for the Shahab-3 missile. All of that was prior to 2003. You know, 2003 was 17, 18 years ago, and they were doing all these things. In other words, they had all the technological building blocks you need for an atomic bomb 17, 18 years ago. If you look at where the United States was during the World War II Manhattan Project, when the United States was enriching uranium, when we did successful implosion testing, when we were manufacturing neutron initiators, bridge wire detonators, when we were designing nuclear warheads, back in the 1940s during the Manhattan Project, we were only a few months away from actually being able to build a bomb. And we built the bomb. We built two atomic bombs of radically different designs, one an implosion device and one a gun device, one fueled with plutonium and another one fueled with uranium. We did this using 1930s and 1940s era technology at a time when no one even knew if it was possible to build an atomic bomb. We did it in just 3 years. And Iran reached that stage that we were at during the Manhattan Project before 2003, 17 to 18 years ago. Does it make sense that the United States could build, you know, the atomic bomb? Two different designs, both of them, which worked, you know, when they were just a gleam in Albert Einstein's eye, using 1940s and 1930s era technology. We could do that in 3 years, but Iran supposedly hasn't been able to do it in 17 or 18 years, even though they reached the same technological point that we did back during the Manhattan Project. It makes no sense. That's why we think that Iran already has nuclear weapons, that they already have the bomb. In fact, they may even be as advanced as North Korea. They just don't want to tip their hand and do testing in Iran. They might have tested their weapons in North Korea. You know, every North Korean nuclear weapons test, according to reports, Iranian scientists have been present there. And we know North Koreans are in Iran helping with the Iranian missile program. They're probably helping them with their nuclear program, too. These are scientists from North Korea who are permanently residing in Iran to help them with their programs. We also point out in our article that Iran can build sophisticated nuclear weapons by relying on component testing without nuclear testing. You know, the first atomic bomb we built, the Hiroshima bomb, you know, was never tested. We didn't have to do detonation testing, even though it had never been done before. Our Manhattan Project scientists were so confident in the design of that bomb that we didn't test it. The test was actually Hiroshima, you know, and it worked perfectly, destroyed Hiroshima. And Iran can do the same thing. You know, we didn't actually test it to a nuclear yield. We just tested the various components, the neutron initiators, the bridge wire detonators, the implosion system, all of that worked fine. And when we put highly enriched uranium into it, that's what the fuel was, it destroyed Hiroshima. The UN inspections done by the International Atomic Energy Agency are limited to civilian sites in Iran. They can't go into Iranian military bases, or at least they haven't tried, they haven't asked you to. And there are several highly suspicious underground facilities in Iran where Iran has almost certainly got a clandestine nuclear weapons program. One of those underground facilities, you know, has got these high power electric lines that go for miles across the desert and then they dead end. The wires go right into the ground. They're doing something underground that requires, you know, hundreds of thousands or even millions of volts of electricity. Well, what could that be? To build an atomic bomb requires huge amounts of electricity, you know, because you have to run thousands of uranium centrifuges. It's one of the only explanations for why you would want to be doing something at a secret underground facility that requires hundreds of thousands or billions of volts of electricity, building the bomb. You know, so that you can refine, get enriched uranium and do plutonium separation. We think that Iran is building toward a large, deployable, one more fact, okay, that isn't widely understood. The newspapers keep talking about, and I think the Israelis think, you know, that Iran needs so-called weapons-grade plutonium, or uranium, which is uranium highly enriched over 90% in order to build a bomb. Almost every article you read on the Iranian nuclear weapons program makes that claim. Well, they've got to get 90% enriched uranium or plutonium for an A-bomb. And they need 5 to 10 kilograms, according to almost everything that the press writes about the Iranian program. And they say they use that estimate, 5 to 10 kilograms, because a lot of academics who don't know what they're talking about and don't understand nuclear weapons design look for guidance to the Manhattan Project, the World War II Manhattan Project, and they see, oh, we used about 5 to 10 kilograms of highly enriched uranium or plutonium in the early atomic bombs. Actually, we used a lot more enriched uranium even than 10 kilograms. In the first atomic bomb, and the one that destroyed Hiroshima. The plutonium bomb did use about 5 kilograms, but those were primitive bombs. They were the first bombs ever built. They were over-designed, you know, to make sure they would work. A good design by a bomb designer who knows what he's doing requires far less than that, only 1 to 2 kilograms of highly enriched uranium or plutonium. And you can build crude atomic bombs with uranium or plutonium that's enriched only to 50%. Only 50%. Iran has been enriching uranium in recent months to over 60%. So we believe that Iran is building toward a large, deployable, survivable war-fighting missile force, to which the Iranians can add nuclear weapons as they manufacture them and swiftly acquire a large war-fighting missile force. And we believe that Iran wants to preserve the fiction of its non-nuclear status for a number of reasons. You know, for one thing, they're in a dangerous neighborhood. You know, they're very concerned about the Israelis, you know, making a strike or and or convincing America to come in to make a strike on their underground nuclear facilities. So they have every reason to pretend that they aren't interested in getting nuclear weapons and they don't have nuclear weapons yet, to forestall Israel and the United States, you know, from attacking their nuclear program. They also have an interest in exploiting nuclear diplomacy. You know, Iran has derived far more economic and strategic benefits from its threatening to go nuclear than has North Korea from going nuclear overtly. You know, look at the pallets of cash and the tolerance of Iranian support of terrorist movements all over the world. Iranian, in effect, building a terror empire. So they've penetrated into Iraq, into Yemen, to Lebanon, into Syria. They've done all that, and the Obama administration and every administration has put up with it because they want to make nice with the Iranians, because we don't want Iran to build a bomb. So by appeasing Iran, you know, we hope that they won't build nuclear weapons. So Iran has all these reasons to keep quiet about its nuclear weapons program. But most concerning to us, and most ominously, is that Iran may be foregoing the deterrence benefits of an overt nuclear posture because it is building towards surprise future employment to advance the global theological agenda of the Ayatollahs and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the world's largest and most sophisticated terrorist organization. Iran is not a normal nation state. You know, it is a theocracy. It doesn't think in terms of the geopolitics and economics of a normal nation state. You know, it has a theological agenda. The Ayatollahs have even said, you know, they don't care if Iran goes up in smoke if they can win the spiritual war against the infidels of the world and make Islam the dominant ideology, the dominant religion, to win the world for Allah. And I think that's what they're doing. That all of us who drafted this article, that includes many senior national security experts, former directors of the CIA and of the Strategic Defense Initiative, the National Intelligence Council, White House advisors, you know, we've been sort of lonely voices in the wilderness trying to warn about this, that we think Iran not only already has the bomb, but they've had it for years, that they've been arming up a missile force, and that when they're ready, when the signs and portents tell the Ayatollahs that it's time to strike, they will. You know, and the purpose will be not to advance the interests of the Iranian people, but to prevail in a global jihad against all the non-Islamic nations, and including against Muslim nations that don't agree with radical Shia beliefs, against fellow Muslims as well. And that's the threat we face. And we think Washington is even more wrong about the Iranian nuclear threat than they were about Afghanistan. This is another example of where we can't trust the boobs in Washington. And think about this, 20 years after 9/11, Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran all have motives to support an act of nuclear terrorism that might drive a demoralized U.S. into isolationism and create a new world order dominated by themselves. You know, what I mean by that is, if you're Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, and you are looking at the United States today, and you're thinking, what can we do to drive America off the world stage so that we can dominate the world? What can we do to change the world order so that the United States will back off everywhere and go into an isolationist crouch? What could we do? You know, we could risk a big World War III. Or maybe we could do it with a small attack, you know, use an act of nuclear terrorism that the U.S. will have hard time figuring out who did it. Could be any one of us, could be all of them in combination, to do an act of terrorism to destroy a U.S. city. What would the reaction of the American people be? Would it be the same as it was 20 years ago? Would it unite Americans? It doesn't seem so. You know, the divisions are so deep, and America is engaged in self-flagellation with this, the leadership, so-called leadership we have in the White House, in the Pentagon, and in our State Department, where they've actually gone in front of the United Nations and blamed America for being institutionally racist. And, you know, we've got to do so much more to reform ourselves. That's been our official position. Faced with such weakness and lack of confidence in America, the Biden administration, in effect, I believe, is unwittingly tempting our enemies to think that America is so weak and has so little confidence in itself that our reaction to an act of nuclear terrorism would be to retreat from the world. To retreat from the world, to go into isolationism. And that would create a power vacuum into which Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran would step to take over leadership of the world, dominance of the world. And that is where we are today, my friends, on this 13th of September in the year of our Lord, 2021. Thank you for listening to another edition of the Pry Report. God bless you and God save the United States.